This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our show today is about a big change for a public radio program we love, one with a devoted following that expanded the definition of a radio voice, tells such compelling true stories that movie producers look to it for screenplay ideas, and has a host that David Mamet described as having reinvented radio.
Well, it's This American Life. I'm Ira Glass. Each week on our show, we choose a theme, bring you different kinds of stories on that theme.
We're used to hearing Ira open his show that way, but the opening we just heard isn't from his radio program. It's from the new TV adaptation of This American Life. It premieres March 22nd on Showtime. Like the radio show, the TV version will tell personal stories with unusual revelations, but we'll be able to see the stories unfold. And that visual dimension has created a lot of opportunities and problems to solve for the Peabody Award-winning executive producer and host Ira Glass. And we wanted to hear all about it. Ira, welcome back to Fresh Air. One of the real trademarks of This American Life is the opening of each radio show in which you tell us what the theme is and what each act is going to be. Now, you do that in the TV show, too, but the question faced you when you were doing the TV show: will we see you telling us this? Are you going to be on camera? Are you going to be off camera? And if you're on camera, what are you going to be doing? So would you describe what your solution is to that question?
Yes, our solution is that I do appear in the show. That was a huge fight in and of itself among us on the staff of figuring out what would be more disappointing, seeing me or not seeing me. You know what I mean?
Like, I know exactly what you mean.
Billy Collins, the poet laureate, has a thing that he says where he says, one of the most inevitably disappointing experiences is meeting the author. And I feel like that goes like twice as much for radio people, you know what I mean? Like seeing the radio people. But anyway, so once we decided that I would appear because it seemed a little artsy to never appear, what we did is our director and our designer, Chris Wilcha and Kira, the designer, they basically said, like, okay, we're going to do the most traditional possible thing that you can do on television, which is we're going to give you a desk, you know. And if you think about Leno, Letterman, Jon Stewart, the news guys, they give you a desk, except in our case, the desk will just go places. And so you'll be on a mountainside in Colorado. You'll be in the oil fields of wherever. You will be you'll be on a factory floor, and a steel beam will be going by your head. But you will never acknowledge where you are. And we all kind of, the minute they said it, it seemed like the obvious choice because first of all, it's taking the convention, but it's doing something different with it. And then also the TV show is incredibly photographic. Like, it's designed as something where the photography is really a character in the show, and the way the music is a character in the radio show. You know, the photography is just very ambitious, and it would let the cinematographer and the director create these incredibly beautiful, composed shots.
And just to explain, you know, when you say your desk travels, it travels to a location that kind of visually describes what the theme of that day's show is.
Often, though some of the themes, honestly, we couldn't think of locations that would go with the theme. Like some of the themes are just like a little abstract. So for some of them, like Pandora's Box, I'm on a lawn in a suburban house, and behind me, you see like, you know, nuclear power station. So that one we could do, but what was the one? One of them, like we just got stumped, and so we just chose the prettiest thing we could find.
Which was?
It was, it's not Pandora's Box, My Way. And My Way was so vexing. And we thought, like, well, we have a theme, My Way, and all the stories are people who sort of do it their way. And first of all, on the radio, you could actually play the Frank Sinatra song. But on television, we would have to license the song for broadcast on television, which would cost tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars. So we couldn't actually use the song My Way. And then we thought, well, one way around it, let's not use the Frank Sinatra song. Let's get a high school marching band to perform My Way. And we'll have this sort of visual spectacle. And there's something kind of funny about the notion of this desk, which looks just like, you know, a TV anchor desk or Letterman's desk, sitting in the middle of like a football field with people marching around it. And again, never comment on it. But then like that seemed like a problem, and also it would be incredibly expensive even to license the My Way, like, you know, instrumental marching band version. And then we just kind of went through one idea and another, and then we just decided, forget it, let's just go to the side of a mountain. It'll be really pretty.
Now, on radio when you do your introductions. There's something like really naked about it. I mean, you're just like talking to me on the radio. Yeah. You're just like telling me what the show is about. And on TV, it's kind of headed in another direction. It's almost like surreal because you and your desk are in a location that a desk doesn't belong, someplace like outside by a mountainside or in front of a nuclear plant or whatever. And it's incongruous, almost surreal to see you at the desk in this location. And so do you feel like in some ways when you're doing television, it's heading in the opposite way, direction of the radio show? Because the radio show, like, it's about the introductions anyways, like it's naked. You're just talking.
Yes, is the short answer. Yes. I mean, the radio show is intimate. Radio is incredibly intimate. And there's just no way to have that kind of intimacy on TV. And one of the things that I never really thought about, like until we did this as a TV show, is it had never occurred to me, like when one performs on the radio, when you talk on the radio, you're in a room and it's incredibly quiet. And so it's this quiet, very personal sort of space. And you're talking into a microphone. And the microphone is just like 3 or 4 inches from your mouth. Like I'm talking into a microphone that's close enough that I could kiss it right now, you know? And right now as I speak. And so it's this incredibly sort of quiet personal space, and it's really easy to perform the thing so that it feels like you're just talking to somebody because of that space. Whereas on television, like if you think about it, like the camera is really far away from the person on television. You know what I mean? Like you'd never think about this if you just watch TV, but like I would be on those shoots and the camera would be pointing at me and it would be like 15, 20 feet away. And there's lighting gear and there's like a crew. And then you're just supposed to talk in an utterly normal tone of voice to somebody who's like 20 feet away from you. And it's just so odd as a performance situation. And really, if you think about it, you're actually, when it gets broadcast, you're talking to somebody who's sitting and watching from the other side of the room. So you're even physically far from them. And so, you know, I think there's lots of things that are kind of fun about TV, but the intimacy of radio, you totally lose.
But you manage to talk pretty directly to the television. I've had to do that like once or twice, and I look like I'm absolutely lost. You know, I think I look like cross-eyed and that I don't know where I am or who I'm talking to. It's really hard to, unless you're a real pro, I think it's really hard to talk to a camera as if the camera was a person sitting in their living room watching you. But it seems like you've learned to do that.
I feel like a faker when I'm doing it. Like, you know what I mean? Like that's the thing that's so different is that I feel totally like I'm faking. And this just shows how immature I am in doing it is that for TV, it just the nature of it is that we do take after take after take, whereas on the radio, you don't really do that. You just kind of sit down and you try to act sincere and you say your thing and try to get it over. And like I would do take after take and I would feel so, and partly like because like did you have this like I would sort of turn my shoulder a little bit or I would like dip a shoulder as I speak or it turns out it's swiveling the chair in the wrong way and they'd be just like no that just looks weird or it turns out that when I speak I close my eyes a lot as I talk and all of these things just look terrible on camera and they would just no just do that again you sound good but just do that again and like so I'd do it like over and over and over and like every single time trying to like be utterly like sincere. I have never said this before in my life. I'm just talking to you, and you know we're on like take 12, and then they're like, okay, now let's do the medium shot, and then you say the every exact same thing like over and over and over again. And I felt so embarrassed, and I know this is really ridiculous in front of the crew, like that I'm acting like I'm sincere, but I'm just saying the same thing over and over. And it was very odd. And I actually feel like in the early episodes, the only reason why it looks halfway good is because we have the power to edit out all the bad takes.
Now, one of the stories that you did on the TV show is a new version of a story that you did years ago on This American Life before it was even a nationally heard show, back when it was just heard in Chicago. And this is the story of a kind of famous or infamous hot dog place in Chicago called the Wiener Circle. And I, before we go any further, I just want you to describe what the atmosphere there is like.
The Wiener Circle is one of these places where the patrons yell at the staff and the staff yell at the patrons. Though I say that and you might picture kind of a cutesy version of that where, you know, it's kind of shtick or something. And it's not shtick at all. Like people are really that really they say stuff that's actually shocking to each other. And what happens on Friday and Saturday nights is a lot of people come out of the bars late at night and they go to this place. And then it's a kind of crazy free-for-all between the white, mostly sort of yuppie North Side Chicago people and the all-black staff working there. And so it's got this weird racial component, and there are drunk people, and it's just quite a scene.
To give us a flavor of it, here's an excerpt of your TV version of the story, and you're talking to one of the employees who insults the customers.
Well, here's the go.
Was it easy to get into?
No, it wasn't easy at first. But then you know what? Okay, let me see how I started. I took an order, and I think a guy said, hey, you fat b-, let me get a hot dog. You know, that's on my speed. You know, I'm from the hood, so all fat, what? So it just started from there. Your mama fat, mother, and it just started from there. Tip the bucket. You
ain't from Christ.
Tip the bucket.
I did tip it.
You didn't tip.
And that's a clip from the TV version of This American Life. Now, I heard the radio story and the TV story, and they were done, I don't know, what, like 12 years apart or something?
Yes.
And not only do you use the mediums, you know, in really interesting ways, you know, TV for the TV version and radio for the radio version, but your conclusions about what's going on there seem to be a little different 12 years ago than they are for the TV version that you just completed. Did your opinions of the place and what's going on there change?
Yes. Yeah, they did. I mean, it's possible that it's just gotten a lot harsher there in the last 12 years. That seems entirely possible. And then a part of it is honestly, like, when you're standing there with an audio tape recorder in the middle of this kind of melee, you focus on a different kind of moment. Like you end up doing these little micro moments with people on the sides, and there's a lot of like the customers talking to the other customers and things like that. And there's something about seeing the racist stuff being hurled back and forth, and it does get pretty racial between the staff and the customers. There's something about seeing it. When you see it, it just looks a lot harsher. And so I guess I'm saying, like, part of it is it may have gotten worse, but part of it really might be just the difference between radio and television. It's so bare on TV how unbelievably disturbing it is. And truthfully, like I remembered it as being kind of harsh, but I remembered it as being like way sweeter. Like that there was something friendlier about it when I was there 12 years ago and stayed there all night with a tape recorder. Going back with the crew, we all felt diminished by the experience. We all just felt like we really saw some things we wish we hadn't seen.
I should say here that in the radio version, the one that done 12 years ago, you talked about how it was kind of like theater and dinner, and that how all the employees seemed to really actually like each other a lot and enjoy the theatrical aspects of insulting the customers and being insulted in return, enjoying that a lot more than just a kind of conventional fast food job. And that there was a lot of genuine affection behind the scenes. And in the TV version, you're basically thinking, boy, this is like Pandora's box. We're seeing, let people talk this way to each other, and you see things you really wish you hadn't seen.
Yeah, and I think part of it is just the mix of personalities and you know, it's different people, different staff. And it just looked different to see it, like to actually like have the camera in the middle of it. It just bears witness in this way.
Do you find that when you show up with a camera crew, that the camera's presence and the crew's presence affects what's going on around you in a way that, like, the radio microphone didn't necessarily?
Yeah, but I think it would be easy to exaggerate that.
Mm-hmm.
In a certain way, people are so used to cameras and the idea of a TV crew that you kind of know what you're in for. Like, you know what you're getting, you know what it is, you know how to relate to it if you're somebody in a place and a camera crew shows up. Whereas, like, a random guy with, like, a cassette recorder, you know what I mean? Just, like, you don't even know what it is. You know what I mean? It's so random that, like, that can be a little weird. And then you know, in the place where really, you know, a lot of a story gets built, which is in the interviews, the same thing happens in the TV interviews that happens in the radio interviews, which is at the beginning, people can be a little self-conscious. But if you're talking about something that actually is something that really means something to them, you know, then it's easy to lose yourself in the conversation, and they'll lose themselves in the conversation.
My guest is Ira Glass, the host and executive producer of the public radio program This American Life. A new TV adaptation premieres on Showtime March 22nd. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Ira Glass, and he is about to premiere the TV version of his public radio program, This American Life. The TV version will premiere on Showtime on March 22nd. When you embarked on this, did you try to get advice from other people who'd been in public radio who moved over to television permanently or temporarily? And I mean, that includes Robert Krulwich, Deborah Amos, Cokie Roberts, Scott Simon.
I mean, the only person I really talked to about it in a big way was Krulwich, and Krulwich, you know, is such an amazing force on the radio. He has such a distinctive style, and he has such a personality on the radio, and he's so like funny and interesting and emotional, even when he's doing sort of a science story. He's so noticeable as a reporter, and it's such a clear voice. And then on TV, he had figured out a way to do the same thing at ABC. His TV work is so different from anybody else's. And he said this thing which I do totally haunted me, where he said that on the radio, once you get to a certain point of experience, you know, a couple years in, and you know what you're doing, basically you can kind of make anything work. You know what I mean? Like if you have a point to make, you can generally make it. You can figure out a way to make it. And if your interviewee doesn't totally give you the goods, well, then you sort of paraphrase for them and you cut back to them for another moment. And just, you can always kind of get your point across. You can work around the tape. It's just a very flexible medium. And he said, TV, the thing about it that's so weird is that you can do everything right. You know, you set up the whole thing right. You get your story right. You get the quotes and all. And some weird, random thing will happen that will utterly kill it. And it could be just something as small and subtle as at the key moment in the quote, the person breaks eye contact with the camera and looks away. And so suddenly the quote doesn't have the power it should. Or the person is doing something or is wearing some clothes that are distracting, or there's something in the background of a shot that distracts at the key moment. And he just said, like, it's just weirdly vexing.
And has that proved to be true?
Oh my God! Yeah, totally. I mean, in the first story we shot, there's this moment where it's the story of this guy, and he loves this bull, and the bull dies, and then he basically brings it back to life through cloning, and then the clone tries to kill him, and we're at the hospital, and in the radio version, we made a radio version of this story. Because we didn't know if the TV show would ever air, so we thought, like, this is a good story. So we made a radio version and put it on the air. And in it, there's this moment where the producer I was with, Jane Feltes, has this totally emotional moment where she describes what happened when this bull tried to kill the guy, and her voice is shaking, and it's this totally gripping, effective moment of radio, When we went to put together the TV version, I was like, well, we got to use that. Like, that's the emotional center of this scene. Like, that's where you feel the feeling of it. And we put it together, and then you see Jane standing there, and she's this sort of 20-something from Chicago with a nose ring and streaks in her hair and cute clothes. And you just think, like, what's she doing in Texas? It just seems like you know what I mean? And she seems so scared by what had happened, but the rancher's wife seems sort of unconcerned. And then you think, well, maybe the city people just don't know what they're talking about, which wasn't true. I mean, he was in tremendous danger. He did almost die. I don't know. The fact of the way she looked registered so randomly, the nose ring and all that, that your mind wandered at what should be the emotional center of the story. And so we had to kill it. We killed it. And so instead we sort of make that scene work differently where we filmed on the way to the hospital and, you know, you there's the drama of getting to the hospital and him being wheeled out. And so you see him all beat up and there's a feeling to that too, this guy who you've spent the whole story with, seeing him all messed up like that. So there was a way to cover for it. But the fact that we couldn't use what was the most emotional piece of tape in the story was just very strange.
Why don't I just play, because we have a clip of it, the moment that you're talking about that you couldn't use on television because of the piercings and how incongruous she looked on this ranch.
I screamed and I didn't want to look at it because I thought he was going to, like, kill him, you know, and I didn't want...
And what did you see?
Like, I just saw him, like, fly up in the air, and then the bullet, it was loud. It seemed really loud because it was at the corner of the fence. So he threw him up in the air, and he landed, like, on the corners of the fences, and he's ramming him in the ground into the fence. So the fences are all shaking, and the bull's making all the noises. And it seems like the bull's going to break through the fences after he's done killing him. You know what I mean? It just, it was very, very loud, very, very fast.
So that's a tape you couldn't use. Is it hard to let go of a good moment when you really want it to work but you can't get it to work?
Oh my God, yeah. I mean, and that would happen. That would happen a lot in all of these very, very small mm-hmm. ways. But my job since I was 19 on the radio has been to find really great moments of tape and figure out how to get those moments into the story because those will have a lot of meaning and feeling. And so I feel like that's all I know how to do, right? And so then I would be in this situation where I'd feel like, this is really nice tape and it says so much about her. And so there must be a way that we can get the good tape into the show. And we would put it in. It would just be like, it just didn't work. And it was so like crazy making. And I would just feel like, is there something wrong with me? And then at some point, as we got further into it, like, I think I and the other producers from the radio show, we sort of learned the rhythm of television. We learned the pacing of a television story and the way and because there are places where you can totally digress, and there are places where you can totally, like, let a person talk, and you can have, like, very, very lovely moments and funny moments, but they're completely different places than on radio.
Ira Glass is the host and executive producer of the public radio program This American Life. A TV adaptation of the program premieres on Showtime March 22nd. Ira will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Virginia Woolf's early novel Night and Day, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, David Bianculli reviews The Black Donnellys, the new NBC drama co-written by Paul Haggis, who also co-wrote the films Million Dollar Baby and Crash. And we talk more with Ira Glass about making radio and movies. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Ira Glass, the host and executive producer of the Peabody Award-winning public radio show This American Life. A new TV adaptation of the show premieres March 22nd on Showtime. Public radio people pride themselves on being able to create stories without pictures. We've been talking about what it's like for a brilliant radio producer like Ira to cross over to TV and have to start thinking visually. There's a lot of times when radio producers close their eyes and just listen. Like if you're trying to see how like a film clip sounds, you might close your eyes and just listen to the film clip to see if it would work on the radio. Mm-hmm. Do you feel after a long period of kind of closing your eyes to do your stories that now you've like opened your eyes and you're trying to like see the world in a way that you've never looked at it before? Because in addition to just like listening now for your work, you have to see for your work too. So just in like your day-to-day life, are you seeing things that you never paid attention to before?
I wish that the answer to that would be yes, because it's such an interesting question. And like, no. I mean, the place where it's true, where it is different, is when I watch television and movies.
Uh-huh.
Because now I notice all these things that I never would have noticed before. Like literally, I'll be sitting on the couch with my wife and something will happen. I'll be like, oh, wow. Is that a two-camera setup? And she'll just like hit me. And she'll be like, what's happened to you? You know what I mean? And like, I'll notice things like in the commercials where I'll be like, wow, the lighting on that, like, well, how are they doing that? Like, what's the light source on that? You know, like in the past, the only annoying things I would do is like I would get so obsessed with like the music that plays underneath stuff. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. like where like music is playing underneath something on TV or in a movie. Like, I'd become obsessed with that and would totally notice a music entrance and like, you know, like with my wife, like we'll be watching, you know, the Gilmore Girls, and one of the lousy music cues, they have lousy music cues on that show, will come on and I'll go like, she'll hear me like taking my breath. She'll go like, I know, honey, I know the music. And, you know, like so that she was used to. And but now there's a whole other thing.
Now, in addition to like doing this new TV show, you've also been starting to work on movies. You're writing a screenplay, but you also have this deal now with a movie company that they get first look, which means they get to hear they get to hear or read this American Life stories and make a bid to make a movie on it before anybody else does. And the first movie has been made based on that process, and that movie came out before the holidays. It was called Unaccompanied Minors. And I just want to ask you a few things about that adventure.
Sure.
And let's start with what the story was itself. It was based on this American Life story about children of divorced parents who around Christmas are flown without adult supervision to the other parent. So if the mother has custody Christmas, they're flying to see their father. And this is a story about what happened one December 26th when the kids were at the airport going back to the parent where they lived, and there was such a bad snowstorm that all the flights were grounded, and the kids were all kind of herded into a big room. So you had all these like children without parents in this like big room together. And I want to play a short excerpt of Susan Burton's story from This American Life. So here she is being escorted to the room with all the other children of divorced parents who are stranded at the airport, and she's with her sister Betsy.
A second woman appeared, and we followed her to a gray, unmarked door. She fumbled with her keys. I squeezed Betsy's hand. The door opened onto a room packed with kids sitting on their winter jackets. There were dozens of kids, all kinds of kids, some in small groups, the young ones conversing with stuffed animals, others looking uncomfortable in dresses or overheated in moon boots that had been too big to pack. Most of them were facing a podium at the front of the room, as if they'd been dropped off at the public library and were waiting for a reading by Shel Silverstein.
Okay, so in that scene, it's like kids look like they're waiting for a reading by Shel Silverstein. But here's the movie version where, you know, the kid in the movie is getting led into the room at the airport with all the kids who are stranded.
Yeah.
So here's the movie version.
Yeah.
Where are we going?
Somewhere really fun.
Are we going to prison?
No, we're going to have fun with all the other kids who are flying by themselves.
Welcome to the Unaccompanied Minors Room.
And it's nothing but mayhem after that.
Yes.
With kids doing every kind of mischief known to man, which is really like such a far departure from the story, from the radio story. So could you see that coming right away, that the movie version was going to be so completely different than the radio version?
Yes. And we actually embraced that. I mean, it never occurred to us that this could be a movie, and producers came to us and said, like, this could be a comedy for kids. based on this premise. And so we knew from the start that it would be very different than Susan's story. Susan's story is a memoir, and it's wistful and it's sad, and it's written for adults. And, you know, it's not targeted at 8-year-olds. And so we knew that, you know, it was going to be a kid's comedy, and that the idea was that all these kids of divorce would end up in a room together, and then it would be Christmas, and they would have an adventure, and they'd make Christmas together. And truthfully, like, this is the kind of thing where there have been other movies in this deal that we've been very, very active as a staff in trying to make the movies happen, and been very involved in the script writing process, and in trying to, you know, see that certain stories get told a certain way. But this was one where really somebody came to us and we felt like we had no expertise about making a kids film, and we just said, like, that seems good, you know, like, go, you know, go with it, you guys do it. And they got a director who we really liked, Paul Feig, who did Freaks and Geeks, and we just felt like, you know, go to it. There's an interesting story about Unaccompanied Minors, and that is that the movie version originally the original script had way more divorce stuff in it, and this is something that would never happen on the radio show. It had way more divorce stuff, and so there were moments. For example, there's one moment in particular where the kids are sort of like having their caper and trying to make Christmas, and they round a corner and they're feeling really triumphant and like we're so happy and like divorce kids rule, and they round a corner and they see like a nuclear family, which is actually just sort of sitting on the floor, and the mom is caring for the kids and the dad is there with the kids, and they're having this really sweet moment, and the divorce kids totally come up short, and they stand there, they stare at it, and they feel really, really bad.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the studio executives basically said, once we were into production, said he just thought like divorce was too much of a downer, and could we please get more of the divorce out of the film? and this executive himself was divorced and had kids through the divorce, and just whatever, you know, and he just thought he was reacting from his heart, like he would not want to go to that film with his kids, you know what I mean? And then you don't even know what to say, like he's the boss, you know, everybody was working on the film sort of tried to talk him out of it and say like, no, that's what's going to be really great about this film, is it's going to be this romp, but with these like little emotional moments, you know. And look who you hired for it, Paul Feig, the Freaks and Geeks guy. Like that's all that guy does. That's his business, is like funny, 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 deeply sad. Funny, 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 deeply sad. And so this thing that I think would have given the film more emotional ballast, and I think really would have made it more special. I mean, I like the film, but I think it would have made it more different. And also something I think like divorce kids would treasure a little more.
Mm-hmm.
In the end, like it just couldn't survive.
And you're writing or have written a screenplay now?
Have written. Yeah. And this was this thing where under our deal, basically our deal specified that if we spotted anything that could be a movie, we had to alert the movie studio. And so a friend of a friend had written this nonfiction book called Urban Tribes that was about basically people getting married later and later. People get married much, much later than they did even 20 years ago. And in the middle of this nonfiction book, there was the perfect plot of a romantic comedy just sitting right there. And so I said to, you know, our studio executives, hey, you guys should know about this. It's a very zeitgeisty book about, you know, the way people in their 20s and 30s live today. And in the middle of it, there's a romantic comedy, like a perfect romantic comedy plot, you know. And they said, that sounds great. In fact, our this was when we were at Warner Brothers. Now we're at DreamWorks. When we were at Warner Brothers, the executive who was our guy was this guy named Kevin McCormick, who his whole early career was making very of-the-moment films. His very first film was Saturday Night Fever, which came from an article in New York Magazine. And so when I saw Urban Tribes, I thought, like, well, that's exactly what Kevin loves, is these things that express, like, this is a particular moment in time in our country. And the fact that it had a perfect romantic comedy plot where the guy, I mean, in the book, Ethan Waters, the writer, basically the book opens with his girlfriend. Like, he wants to go off with his friends on this thing they do every year, and she wants him to come to her best friend's wedding, and she can't understand, like, how his friends could be so important. And she basically gives him this speech and says, like, you live like children. Like, you know, you're not leading an adult life, calling each other 50 times a day and sending each other emails and having bowling night and dinner night together and all the things you do. Like, you're not living like an adult. And eventually he has to choose between the friends and the girl, and it's a kind of a natural romantic comedy plot. And in the end, in the book, he chooses the girl, and of course in a movie he would too. And anyway, so we presented this to Kevin, and Kevin is like, great, and basically hooked us up with this director who did this film that I loved called Roger Dodger. And the director's name is Dylan Kidd. And so then, like, just it was just every weekend for just months we would work on this thing. And I got to say, like, it was really, really fun.
Do you hear dialogue differently as a result of it?
Yeah, and I noticed the conciseness of dialogue. Like there are moments in movies, like, there's a moment, like, it'll happen in the dumbest movies. Like I saw Fantastic Four in a hotel room, and there was, like, a moment where they have to get across the relationship of the man and the woman, the couple, and they do it in, like, one phrase and a look. And I was just like, wow, that's efficient. Or in The Devil Wears Prada, there's this moment where she comes back from the big party, and it's the boyfriend's birthday, and they have to have the fight, and they do it in, like, one shot, where she walks in, she's got the cupcake, she's got the candle, he gives her a look, he crosses to the other room, and you're like, wow, you could not do that in fewer seconds, get across the feeling of this scene. Like it's so efficient, you know? And I never would have noticed that before writing a movie.
My guest is Ira Glass, the host and executive producer of This American Life. A new TV adaptation premieres on Showtime March 22nd. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Ira Glass, and he's starting a TV version of his radio program, This American Life, and the TV version premieres on Showtime on March 22nd. You are so associated with public radio, I mean, as being like a person who kind of created a whole new style in public radio and who's been in public radio since you were a teenager. Now that you're spending more time in television and in movies, do people ever make you feel like you're cheating on a spouse by, you know, like having an affair with another medium?
Less than you'd think, actually. Like it's funny because you know, trying the TV show, especially like we all on the staff of the radio show, we're very worried about the people who like the radio show and if they would feel betrayed and if they would go with us. And people have been surprisingly gracious, actually. I mean, maybe this is just what they say to you if you're the on-air person. You know what I mean? Like if they meet you, they just don't want to be, like, rude to your face. But I've done now many, many, many public radio events in Chicago and in different cities around the country at different stations. And people really seem to be curious about the TV show and to have an attitude of kind of like, go get them, you know, like, go win one for our team. And so people have been surprisingly forgiving, and we haven't had to get into a kind of a dumb sort of like, which is better, TV or radio? You're like, well, like, which do you love more? Like, who do you love more, TV or radio? Like, you like, you know, that seems sort of like it seems silly. Like, they're different mediums and they're good at different things, and they can live, the farmer and the cowboy can be friends.
What are some of the TV and radio shows that you grew up with and that were, you know, that were really important to you?
I mean, the TV shows that were the most important were really like corny shows. Like I was a huge Star Trek fan when I was a kid, and then there was a period of, like, you know, comedies like The Mary Tyler Moore Show and All in the Family and MASH and just like stuff that was sort of super mega hits that everybody liked. And then on the radio, like I didn't really listen to radio in any serious way until I was in high school. And we didn't get public radio. Like, we didn't listen to it. We weren't a public radio family. I didn't hear of public radio until somebody suggested I look for a job there. And so my hero when I was in high school was a sort of a proto shock jock in Baltimore named Jim Embry, whose on-air name was Johnny Walker, who did jokes in the Little News in the Morning and did bits all morning long and was really quite a force on WFBR 1300 AM. And my senior year in high school, I sent him three pages of jokes and he liked them. And for that whole summer, I would write him jokes. Every morning, I would drive down to WFBR and drop off a sheet of jokes that I could watch him do his show, which was quite exciting. And that was it. If anything, like the things that I think had more effect on me, it would be like the melodrama of Star Trek. I feel like I still carry a little bit of that. Like I love that kind of like melodrama, and I feel like you can definitely that whole idea of like you're going to tell a drama and it's going to be really dramatic, and then it's going to reach for some big universal idea, which is so like at the heart of our radio show and the TV show is totally contained in the corniest nonsense on Star Trek, and then. There's a writer who I like named Jane Espenson who does a blog, and she writes for Battlestar Galactica. And one of the things she says on her blog is that generally when you see the spaceships, you know the big ideas are about to follow. You know, like they're in tow. And then the other thing that was a really big thing for me was just like Broadway musicals. Like I was a Jew growing up in the 60s and that's the stuff that was playing in the house. And all that stuff has the kind of like big dramatic, you know, funny moments and emotional moments and reaching for a big idea and, you know, Fiddler on the Roof and West Side Story and all that stuff.
I don't know how self-conscious you are as a person, but, you know, as a producer of the TV version of This American Life, you have to be looking at the video that you've shot of yourself introducing the show, being on camera.
Oh my God.
And you have to look
at
it critically as a producer and say, this works, this doesn't, you know, I look good in this, I don't look good in that. Looking at it as a producer, not as somebody just like looking in a mirror. And I'm wondering if that exercise is making you any more or less self-conscious as a person.
It's making me, I know this isn't like, it's making me both. It's interesting because when we got into the TV, every time there was a shot of me, I felt so self-conscious about it and thought I looked terrible, truthfully, and felt embarrassed for the way I looked on camera. And I know that this thing had happened with the radio show, which was when I started the radio show, I had always been like my own editor. You know what I mean? Like if I was doing a story, you know, I was just a reporter on NPR. And so I would edit my own tape and I would, you know, I'd record my script and I would edit out the bad takes and all. But, you know, to do a weekly show, you have to kind of be egoless about how you sound. And so other people would edit the interviews and edit my voice tracks. And so I got used to walking by other people's offices and my voice would be coming out of them sounding terrible, you know, like just saying stupid things and bad takes and just whatever. And there came a point pretty early on when I just completely got past that, where I didn't feel embarrassed. And in fact, my voice seemed to me on tape to be just like an industrial product. And I was just hoping, like, God, I just hope that with the pictures, that's going to happen. And episode one came and went. Episode two came and went. Episode three came and went. It's just like, because someday I'm going to sit down with Chris, the director, and Joe, the editor, and we're going to look at the different takes of me sitting out on the salt flats, and I'm at the desk, and, you know, and there I am, and, like, why did my mouth go like that? And, like, what? That's the way my hair really looks to other people and not the way that I think it looks. And just, like, and I'm watching this, and, like, and by the fifth and sixth episode, it was done. It was done. Like I was dead to me. I was over myself. Like I feel like, you know what? I don't look that good to me, but like I actually don't care anymore. And on the radio, I never had that great of a radio voice. And now I'm used to that. And like, that's the way it's going to be on the TV. And I'm not going to think about it anymore.
Of course, people love how you sound on the radio and you look great on TV. So congratulations on the new show. And thanks so much for talking with us about it.
No, thanks so much for having me.
Ira Glass is the host and executive producer of the public radio program This American Life. A TV adaptation of the program premieres on Showtime March 22nd. To celebrate, Ira's taking the show on a performance tour that begins tonight at Lincoln Center's Avery Fisher Hall, continues tomorrow at the Boston Opera House, and goes on to Minneapolis, Chicago, Seattle, and L.A. Thank you. Coming up, David Bianculli reviews the new TV series, The Black Donnellys. This is Fresh Air. Tonight on NBC, a new series arrives from Paul Haggis and Bobby Maresco, whose most recent collaboration was the movie Crash. But this time they're writing for television, and as TV critic David Bianculli points out, it's not the first time.
These days, Paul Haggis has a very impressive movie resume. He wrote or co-wrote the screenplays for Million Dollar Baby and Crash. But long before that, he toiled in the vineyards of TV. I first noticed him as the creator of the fabulously quirky CBS series Due South, which starred Paul Gross as a Royal Canadian Mountie relocated to Chicago. Then Haggis found a collaborator in Bobby Maresco, and their first effort together was one of my all-time favorite TV crime dramas, Easy Streets, starring Ken Olin and Joe Pantoliano. Now they're back writing a TV crime show again, and I'm thrilled to report it's very much in the Easy Streets vein. The Black Donnellys, like Easy Streets, is about the power struggles between rival mobs in a tough neighborhood. This time, the neighborhood is New York's Hell's Kitchen, and the setting is current, even though it evokes an earlier era. The protagonists are the four brothers Donnelly, tough Irish guys who never left the hood and seem destined to turn into hoods if they're not careful. There's a hot-headed brother, a ladies' man, an inveterate gambler, and the responsible brother, who wants to keep his siblings out of trouble, stay straight, and win the heart of the neighborhood beauty he's had a crush on since they were little kids. These roles are all played by relative unknowns. Jonathan Tucker, as the responsible Tommy, is the initial standout, and they're only part of a large, impressive cast. There's also the neighborhood Irish mob boss and the nearby Italian mob boss who's encroaching on the territory. All these factions are struggling for power, while the brothers are fighting either with them or with each other. And the whole complicated story is narrated by a childhood friend of the Donnelly brothers, an opportunistic guy with the memorable nickname of Joey Ice Cream. In this case, ice cream is a flavor that adds greatly to the storyline. As in this scene, when a silly confrontation between one of the brothers, an Irish bartender, and his clientele turns into a Joey Ice Cream observation on ethnic stereotypes.
Ain't no banging on the machines.
What? It took my money.
It's supposed to take your money.
You want to yell in my other ear?
The Irish have always been victims of negative stereotyping.
I mean, people think we're all drunks and brawlers. And sometimes that gets you so mad, all you want to do is get drunk and punch somebody.
Could that funny remark by Joey Ice Cream, played very playfully by Keith Nobbs, offend some viewers? Sure it could. So could some of the strong violence in the show. I've seen 5 episodes, and they contain the most intentionally casual outbreaks of brutality since The Sopranos. But they also contain other hallmarks of Paul Haggis' TV series, including an against-the-grain use of music, some of the most violent scenes are accompanied by the most angelic singing and instrumentation, and surprises that trip you up and take your breath away, even when you're on the lookout for them. Tonight's opening episode contains at least 2 of those. Combined, they manage to echo everything from The Usual Suspects to The Godfather while remaining completely original. The Black Donnellys may not be an easy sell for NBC. On-air promos don't do it justice, and it's the sort of television that demands your full attention. When Joey Ice Cream says one thing while the picture shows something else entirely, it's not the sort of TV show you can watch while multitasking. Good guys, bad guys, seemingly fatal showdowns. Nothing and no one in The Black Donnellys is precisely what it seems. All that you can count on with certainty here is that you will be very solidly entertained.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air is now available as a podcast on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Minhivar. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Virginia Woolf's early novel, Night and Day, in stores and online at bn.com. From TIAA CREF, helping those who serve others plan for and live in retirement, online at tiaacref.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Lowell Bergman talks with us about how the mounting pressure for profits, declining advertising, and internet competition is affecting newspapers. It's the subject of part 3 of his frontline documentary, News Wars. Join us for the next Fresh Air.